May it please the court and counsel. As we stand here in the Fifth Circuit taking a look at the case of USA versus Socorro-Tejas, at this point...
Pull that mic up just a little bit, please, sir.
I will, Your Honor. At this point, neither the court nor any of the counsel know on what statute the district court relied in basing its cross-reference. When Socorro-Tejas first received the pre-sentence report and she objected to the fact that the court was utilizing a provision in the guidelines to cross-reference the alien smuggling statute, the pre-sentence report didn't list what particular statute it was relying on to use that cross-reference. So once Socorro-Tejas received that pre-sentence report, she had to, for all intents and purposes, make a guess, and what she did was she relied on the general alien smuggling statute and proffered good objections.
Well, was an objection filed to the PSR so the government could address that?
It was, Your Honor.
And what did the objection say?
The objection specifically stated that the cross-reference was inappropriate because the alien smuggling statute did not allow for its application in cases where the situs of the offense was a port of entry. And in this case, it was undisputed that the facts of this case occurred at the port of entry. So the narrow objection was, Your Honor, if you're going to try to use a cross-reference, you've got to use a statute that applies to this particular case. And given that the situs of the offense was a port of entry, you can't use an alien smuggling general statute. Probation then responded in the PSR by referencing something called transporting an unlawful alien. They just used the words, but again, no statutory reference whatsoever. So again, Socorro-Tejas below is forced to try to guess at what statute, and again, the most applicable one was the alien smuggling statute, which had the same problem.
Once that was done at sentencing, did Tellez say, you know, we objected, you haven't identified the statute, PSR has just come back, the probation officer, and said, just language, no cite. Was that raised to the district judge?
Absolutely. At the sentencing hearing, what the district court did was told me, I've read your objections, take it up with the Fifth Circuit. And then the district court allowed me to explain a little bit that the alien smuggling statute on which it was relying was absolutely inapplicable. And then there was no discussion whatsoever. The response was take it up with the Fifth Circuit. So again, the question that you asked, Judge Barksdale, is appropriate because even at sentencing, Socorro-Tejas still didn't know what statute the district court was relying on.
Let me ask you this. Did the PSR refer to Section 1324 generally, or did it narrow it down?
It didn't at all, Your Honor. I was the one that came up with a statutory reference. The PSR used the words smuggling aliens into the United States. I was the one that supplied the statutory reference, in a guess.
You referred to 1324?
Yes, sir, I did. In doing so, from Socorro-Tejas' perspective, if I'm at sentencing and I raise objections and probation responds first in an addendum and then in a second addendum and then at the sentencing hearing and nobody corrects my interpretation that the court is relying on 1324, I think the implicit understanding is that's the statute that the court was relying on. Nobody corrected that. But again, we don't know because the court never defined it with any specificity whatsoever.
I think we do know that she was relying on the alien smuggling statute. We don't know what subsection of that she was relying on, maybe. But we do know she was relying on the alien smuggling statute, don't we?
Maybe. In this court's request for a letter brief, though, the court requested an analysis on a separate statute, not 1324, but 1185. And I think that's the testament to the fact that everybody's guessing. Everybody's.
Let's talk about 1324A2.
Yes, sir. 1324A2. That was the basis of my, in the brief where we argued that the aliens actually have to make ingress into the United States. And what I cited in the brief was both Fifth Circuit case law and for what it's worth, the pattern jury instructions that require actually ingress within or in the United States. And I cited case law that stands for the proposition that if the aliens are actually at the bridge or at a port of entry and can't make it in, they're under what's called official restraint. As this
now, aren't you talking about 13A1 with the little 2I? I'm talking about A2.
That's the one I'm referring to, Your Honor. That's the one that requires ingress into the United States. But I think the fact that we're sitting here trying to figure out which statute applies.
Okay, but look, I'm looking at A2, and it says anyone who knowing or in reckless disregard of the fact that an alien has not received prior official authorization to enter U.S. brings to or attempts to bring to the U.S. in any manner violates the statute.
Right. And even with that language, what I did was I took a look at what the Fifth Circuit held were the elements of that particular statute, and all of them required at least ingress into the United States.
Even though it says or attempts to bring in the United States?
Yes, Your Honor. And what I did was the question that was raised in my mind was, can you commit an offense outside of the United States and still have this statute apply? And when I went back and looked at the Fifth Circuit case law, every case to look at
this. How do you attempt to enter the United States without being outside the United States?
That was the question that I looked to. And when I looked at the Fifth Circuit case law, every single case that cites this particular statute and the pattern jury instructions require something, require ingress here. And I don't know whether
you can't complete the attempt unless you complete the act.
You can complete the attempt here. If you're in the United States and you do something in furtherance of smuggling somebody and, say, procuring false documents, procuring a car, hiring somebody to go get somebody to bring them into the United States, that's something that you can do while here. But the Fifth Circuit case law stands for the proposition that this offense is not completed unless somebody's here.
What's your best case that would be that deals with attempt under this section?
Don't know it off the top of my head, Your Honor.
Pardon?
I don't have it off the top of my head. But the cases that I cited in the brief stand for a proposition that ingress need be accomplished. But I think the fact that we're sitting here trying to figure out which statute applies.
Well, but let's look at the fact that we're not dealing with her being charged under 1324A2. We're simply looking at conduct that would allow this use of 2L1.1 or whatever it is, the guideline. We're looking at conduct. And wouldn't that be a distinguishing factor from if we were dealing with the substantive charge defense in the indictment being 1324A2? Maybe under our case law, egress would be required. And I seem to remember we have some, that may well be true. But since we're simply looking at conduct for sentencing purposes, isn't there more flexibility there?
I don't think so, Your Honor, and for this reason. In the cases, I cited an Eighth Circuit case, I think, in my letter brief to the court. But in the circuit cases analyzing the cross-referencing provision, the courts are clear. All the court looks at are the four corners language in the indictment to see if something else applies. The fact that we're sitting here trying to guess, I think, implicates the Supreme Court's recent decision in Gall. Gall lays it out clearly, and I think is dispositive. If this court decides there was significant procedural error below, a vacating of the sentence is mandatory. And Gall defines a significant procedural error as an improperly calculated guideline range. In other words, it puts an affirmative burden on the court to at least engage in the analysis, at least do the calculation. And the fact that we're sitting here trying to guess which statute the district court used, I think means there was significant procedural error. We don't know. And the
let me
fact
ask you about 1185A2. I understand your argument that we shouldn't guess at which statute, but you have an argument that doesn't apply, 8 U.S. 1185A2?
I do, Your Honor. The 1185A2, I think, has a whole host of problems, all of which require some sort of factual analysis that had to be done by the district court, none of which was done. It sounds like a technical argument, but the case law explaining how the cross-referencing provision is used mandates that the elements of the offense meet the conduct described in the indictment. And in this one, obviously, and I don't think this is a superfluous argument, but As I cited in the brief, this statute has never once been cited in any criminal case that I could, published or unpublished. But were it cited, I would assume that one of the elements would be that the President of the United States has not ordered the conduct lawful or unlawful. And I would think that would need to be one of the elements because that's language in the statute. So to the extent that that's not listed in Socrates' indictment,
well,
that's
she didn't say when they asked her, she didn't say, I've got authorization from the President. I mean, all of this gets a little silly, but she didn't say, I'm authorized by the President. Here's my letter of entry.
Correct. And I know it's silly, but if you look at it's not silly. If you look at the technical requirements for the cross-referencing provision, you've got to establish each and every one of those elements. And the courts don't use the word element lightly. It's kind of like in a 1326 case, one of the things that the government has to establish when somebody comes here illegally is that they don't have permission.
Well, I'm not clear about why the facts of this case are not directly under the language of that statute, unless you have some construction of the statute that's not apparent on its face.
The argument is a structural.
I mean, it's the same language as the A2s have the same operative language.
Except for the fact that had the district court alerted me that this was the statute on which it was relying, I could have made some argument. And I don't know. One of the language in the statute includes that the conduct that she engaged in was forbidden by this section. Now, as I look at 1185, if she's engaging in conduct forbidden by this section, it's not readily apparent under which subsection it goes. It certainly doesn't have anything to do with forging, counterfeiting, or mutilating documents of the United States. If there was something there, at least she'd have the opportunity to address it. But as we sit here today, we're trying to shoehorn these facts into a particular statute. And after Gaul, that's not the procedural means by which this court reviews sentences.
What does Gaul have to do with this, man?
Gaul lays out the procedural means by which this court reviews it. And if we're sitting here today trying to figure out what the district court didn't do a calculation. It didn't do an analysis. So when it rises up, first of all, it's prejudicial to the defense because below, if we're raising objections to a statute, and if this court ultimately finds that 1324 is inapplicable, then she should win. But to the extent that it goes a step further and this court fills in what the district court should have done, first of all, Socrates didn't have an opportunity to defend against that down below because she wasn't put on notice and she didn't know. And then secondly, it goes against Gaul because Gaul says if there's procedural error, the sentence is vacated. If the district court calculated the guidelines incorrectly, the sentence is vacated. Now, in the period of time between Booker and Gaul, where this court looked at sentences for purposes of reasonability, perhaps that analysis would suffice. But now, if there's procedural error in calculating the guidelines, the sentence is vacated. And to the extent that the court did no calculation whatsoever, no analysis whatsoever, nothing putting Socrates on notice on what basis she was being cross-referenced and getting a sentence. Well, frankly, it's a sentence a year and a half longer than she otherwise would have received.
Are you familiar with the United States versus Torres Flores, the Ninth Circuit case in 2007? This was a defendant drove up to a port of entry in a cab pickup, told the Border Patrol agent nothing to declare. The agent became suspicious of the hump in the floorboard of the car, and it was an illegal alien. They tried to convict it under this statute. Under 1324A2. So you have the Ninth Circuit applying the statute substantively to conduct that looks very much like what happened here.
Under which, first of all, I'm not familiar with the case, and I don't know under what subsection that went. But if the defense counsel in that case.
It's a fairly common fact pattern. Someone drives up in a vehicle, they have illegal aliens aboard, hidden in some fashion. They are discovered at the point of entry.
They are not, they never enter the United States. They're tried and convicted under this statute. How do you distinguish that from these, from what happened here?
The facts sound similar, but the narrow objection in this one
was... Similar? What's the difference?
Well, the fact is that that she raised a proper objection below. The situs of the offense cannot be a port of entry.
Say it again.
The situs of the offense for the 1324 section that I cited cannot be a port of entry.
A2?
Well, I don't know. I'm trying to guess what the district court did.
Well, I'm asking, though, what about A2?
A2 requires that the situs of the offense be within the United States, and it didn't happen. She never made ingress.
There must be there's some case law construction that says that the conduct has to be from the state side. The person is aiding the alien.
The cases.
The statute doesn't say that.
The cases that I cited in my brief stand for the proposition that the elements of the offense include that the conduct occurred in or within the United States, and those were the cases that I cited in my opening brief.
Okay, thank you, sir.
Just 1 second on my time. As I understand it, the present release date for your client is in January of 2009. January of 2009?
That sounds about right. She got 18 months.
Here. 18 months. And so if there's going to be any remand for resentencing, it needs to be pretty quick. All right. Thank you.
I would agree. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay. Mr. Gay.
Good morning. May it please the Court. In looking at 1324A2,
you get there, why wasn't the statute identified to the district judge? Why was this allowed to happen?
Your Honor, I don't have a very good answer for
that. Wasn't a U.S. attorney there at sentencing?
Yes, Your Honor, and at sentencing.
Why didn't they step up and do something about this?
At sentencing, the district, as counsel explained, the district court basically said, I overrule your objection, take it up to the circuit. And there was very little discussion at sentencing regarding any of the provisions. There were objections filed to the pre-sentence report. The probation officer responded to those, and the report wasn't modified. There was never any attempt by anyone, quite candidly, in looking at the record to clarify the exact provisions that the district
court was relying on. I'm reminded of that famous statement that the government is allowed to strike hard blows but not foul blows, and it just seems that it's incumbent upon the government in a situation like this, even if the judge apparently is just happy to just zip on by, for the government to step up and say, now, Your Honor, we think this needs to be identified, and these are the options. It's very disappointing when the government doesn't do that, and now we're here, and the woman has a release date in January, and it could have all been so cured so easily back at sentencing last March of 2007.
I don't disagree that the record could clearly be better developed in regards to the exact provision that the district court was relying upon. However, the cross-referencing provision specifically does apply in this case, and I think that 1324A2, if you read the exact language of the statute, and I'm not so sure, I'll have to go back and look at the pattern, but under A2, I do not necessarily believe that you have to have situs in the United States or else the attempts to bring to would be rendered wholly inoperative. And I don't believe that was the intent. The pattern set forth in appellant's brief, I think, it focuses under A1. And so I'll have to take a look at that. But my reading of it in preparation of the supplemental brief that I filed was that clearly in this court's questions, I think under 1185A2 and 1324A2, the conduct it set forth in the indictment to which she admitted clearly satisfies the requirements of either statute. And if you look at 1185, appellant's counsel said he had a hard time figuring out which of the provisions it would be. Well, it would clearly fall under number two, which would be for any person to transport or attempt to transport from or into the United States another person with knowledge or reasonable cause to believe that the departure or entry of such person is forbidden by this section. And clearly, when you look at what she admitted to, she admitted that she knew that he was an alien, and she admitted that she knew that he didn't have documents to enter the country. If you look at at appellant's supplemental brief filed with this court, the only argument really presented was that, speculatively speaking, maybe he had documents, but she just didn't have them with him. There is none of the argument advanced this morning was in the supplemental brief in response to what this court had asked for in terms of any other deficiency with either 1324A2 or 1185. The whole focus here, I think, is just an attempt by this court to look at the conduct set forth in the indictment and measure it up to the elements of the statute under that would allow for a cross-reference under 2L1.1, which clearly envisions transporting offenses, as I set forth in my supplemental brief. In this case, there is just no doubt that what she is doing, she is transporting an alien with an attempt to bring him to the United States, and that that conduct clearly falls, in my view, under A2 or 1185A2.
You agree that it can't be covered under A1?
And originally, when I wrote my brief, I think that there is a district court opinion, and it's cited in my original brief. And the more I obviously look at it, I think that there are some challenges there, designated port of entry being primarily. So under A3, which is what I cited to in my brief, then it starts getting into a question of, it seems to me it's interesting because the statute says comes to, enters, or remains. And upon first blush, the comes to, it would suggest to me that that would envision arriving at the port of entry. And perhaps that may have been a bit hasty of an interpretation because it may be that enter and comes to are different ways of effectuating entry into the United States as opposed to simply whether you enter or whether you attempt to enter. But clearly, if you look at the language under 1324A2, brings to or attempts to bring to, those two offenses could not be committed, it would occur to me, and I'll have to go back and look at the pattern specifically for A2, but it seems to me that under 1185 or 1324A2, that her conduct would satisfy the cross-reference. And this isn't a matter of, this is simply a guideline operation. And as this court has said in Medina Argueta, as long as the sentence falls within a properly calculated guideline range, and so this court will affirm. And so I don't believe that if, her conduct does satisfy the cross-referencing provision, that there was significant procedural error under Gall that would require this court to remand. In fact, the legal question of whether this offense meets, whether her conduct meets A2 under 1185 or 1324, I think this court is in a position to make. That is not a factual question that I think the district court necessarily has to resolve. I think this clearly, as counsel said, I think we look at the four corners of the indictment and we just match up the elements. Okay. If there are no further questions, I'll yield back my time. Thank you.
All right, Mr. Flatterer, back to you, sir.
Do I have any time remaining, Your Honor?
Beg pardon?
I didn't know that I had any time remaining. Rather than reiterate which statute applies, I wonder whether this might be a good opportunity for the Fifth Circuit to clarify a district court's obligations in sentencing. In the aftermath of Gall, where Gall unequivocally states that procedural errors mandate a vacating of the sentence and resentencing, and that an improperly calculated guideline is a substantive procedural error mandating that vacating, this doesn't need to happen anymore. To the extent that a court not only doesn't even address but abdicates its responsibility for properly calculating a guideline and then on the record stating take it up with the Fifth Circuit and doesn't give defense counsel or the defendant any guidance as to on what basis it's doing that, this may be a great way for the Fifth Circuit to unequivocally state, okay, the burden is on the district court. The Fifth Circuit is not going to fix these things, and it's not going to guess, and it's not going to fill in, and it's not going to shoehorn. The responsibility after Gall is on the district court not only to engage in analysis of the 3553 factors. This court remands all the time when the district court doesn't address the 3553 factors in a non-guideline sentence. This is a putative guideline sentence in which the court did no analysis whatsoever. So at the Fifth Circuit level, at the Court of Appeals level, we're left to shoehorn in. And I think in the aftermath of Gall, that's a substantive procedural error mandating vacating of her sentence.
All right, sir.
Thank you.
Just clarify for me, please, is the defendant a United States citizen?
She is, Your Honor.
That's what I thought. Thank you.
Shadell, you're court appointed, and you did an excellent job for your client, and the court appreciates your services.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. I appreciate that.
We have your case. All right, we call.